conversion isn't my job, that's God's job. My job is to live faithfully.
The Profile with Premier Christianity Magazine.
Hello and welcome to The Profile, here on Premier Christian Radio with me, Megan Cornwell. This is the show where Christians in the public eye talk about their life, faith and ministry. It's brought to you in association with Premier Christianity Magazine, the UK's leading Christian publication. Today on the show, I'm speaking with the South African Episcopal priest, author and activist, Reverend Canon Mpo Tutu van Firth. She is the daughter of the late Archbishop Desmond Tutu and the founding director of the Legacy Foundation bearing his name.
Mpo, welcome to the show.
Thank you.
You grew up in apartheid South Africa. Can you tell me a bit about what you remember of that brutal system of racial segregation?
Well, I grew up both in England and in South Africa. And it's really hard to describe the apartheid system and living under apartheid. It was so all-pervasive and seemed so much a fact of life for our lives. We lived in very segregated communities. So the Black population, which is the majority of the South African population, lived in what were called townships that were really bedroom communities to service the needs of white South Africa. The housing stock was incredibly poor. The infrastructure almost non-existent. And as compared to the really rather lavish homes of even the poorest of white South Africans. And the expectation was that for white South Africans, life would be good, that it was a society that really was a police state. In the Black townships, you never saw any white people unless they were police or military personnel. There was never, white visitors to the township just coming to visit. It just didn't happen. And so the depth of the segregation and the enforcement of the segregation was really severe, and was deliberate government policy. So most white South Africans, although they would have Black people in their homes as servants, had no idea of what life was in the townships.
And can you describe a bit of what that life was for you and your family? What did that look like when you, because it must have been so strange for you going from living in England to living in South Africa and having that kind of dual identity, that dual experience. Can you talk a bit about that?
Yeah, so we first moved back to South Africa when I was maybe 3 years old. My grandfather was the principal of a school in Munsiville where my father had grown up, or had been. And they lived in a five-room house, literally five rooms. There were two bedrooms, kitchen come dining room come sitting room come living room come everything else, come spare room and guest room and whatever, and then a toilet come bathroom. And they were fortunate because they had indoor plumbing, cold running water for the bathtub and for the and a flush toilet. But that wasn't always so. And my maternal grandmother lived in a one room house where they actually shared communal toilet, which was a, you know, with the bucket system toilet. So once a week, there would be a truck that came through to remove the waste, the buckets of waste from these communal toilets. And then, you know, schools were overcrowded. Classroom would have 50 to 100 students in a single classroom. So you can imagine that the emphasis in the classroom was on managing pupils rather than really imparting an education. I was really fortunate because the years of our living in England coincided with my early education and primary school, and then high school. I went to high school at Waterford in Swaziland, which was an international school that was built by people who really believed that apartheid was insane, and that a sane system was one in which children from every racial group and from every walk of life would learn together. And so that was my experience, which is very different from the experience of South African children. And one of the reasons for that was because my parents had been teachers before the Bantu education system was instituted, and had promised themselves that when they had children, their children would not be educated under Bantu education. And my parents had both left teaching once the Bantu education system was instituted.
Can you just explain what that system was for listeners who
perhaps... So basically, Bantu education was a system of education that said, or as Hendrik Verwoerd, the instigator of that system, said, that there was no point in educating Black children for anything more than servanthood, that their role in life was going to be to provide services for white people. And so the system of education was inferior. The expenditure on education for each Black child was 1/12 of the expenditure on education for every white child. So the government expenditure on, yeah. So it was separate and unequal by deliberate government policy.
In what ways do you think you've been shaped by some of those experiences?
I think, you know, the part of the shaping for me was the very clear sense that race is not a determining factor for anything. It doesn't determine skill, talent, ability. It doesn't. It's an irrelevancy, actually. And I think, you know, that sense of resisting racism is something that has been deeply instilled in me. And not just the obvious systemic racism of an apartheid system, but the systemic racism that exists, in every country, where people make assumptions that are based on race, but have the power to make those assumptions have an impact. That racism is insidious, often because it is unconscious and so invisible. The task of making it visible, making it clear, this is what is happening here, is one that is essential to me, is crucial to me. I think of living as I do now and then in the Netherlands, where the border police here won a case in the Dutch courts that said that they are able to, that it is that racial profiling essentially is permissible under Dutch law. And the notion, the basic definition of racism is prejudice plus power. And so to be able to say, well, I make the judgment on the basis of your race that you are potentially a threat to the society, and so I can hinder your movements, is literally the definition of racism. And yet it's something that, is just kind of blithely swallowed, and we on we go. I went through passport control at Schiphol with my wife, and she walked through, and I, going through those scanner machines, and I was stopped. And when I turned around to look, it was every person of color was stopped for a second examination of their materials, which seems like a small thing, but is basically instilling in people of color that just by virtue of your color, there is something wrong with you, insidious, and that what it does with your mind, as that you're kind of, you're walking around with this sense of, okay, well, what is wrong with me when I have done absolutely nothing wrong? But it is also blasphemous. It is the blasphemy of saying that without doing anything, you're immediately judged to be wrong in your being. You're essentially wrong, as opposed to the promise that God gives us that we are essentially good and right.
Yeah, it's interesting, isn't it? Because we, like you say, we don't have these formal systems anymore, apartheid, Jim Crow, those kinds of historic systems. But yet there is still so much racism, systemic racism, police brutality, entrenched inequalities, where in most countries. How do you think Christians should be using our voices in that space to bring about change?
Well, I think we as Christians so very often are willing to turn a blind eye, to be quiet, to not take up the cause, well, it doesn't affect me. It does affect me and I'm afraid to say anything about it. Neither of which are Christian responses. The Christian response is always, if it affects my sister or my brother, and we are all sisters and brothers, if it affects my sister or my brother, then it affects me. And that as Paul says, perfect love casts out fear. That when we are engaged in loving action, we engage in loving action because it is loving action. And that we pay no regard to our fears. The bumper sticker citation is that courage is fear that has said its prayers. So if we are praying, then we have all of the courage that we need.
Well, talking about courage, that brings me nicely to speaking about the influence of your late father, Archbishop Desmond Tutu. Can you tell me a bit about how his life impacted you and your faith?
That's a good question, and I don't know. He was my father, and so much a part of my life. I'm sure it has impacted me in ways that are visible and in ways that are invisible. That he had a pattern of life that was very much bounded in and by prayer. His action was always preceded and ended with prayer, preceded by and ended with prayer. He was also an English teacher. So I sometimes hear his voice. But also that he was a person of incredible love and compassion. And so it is that really remarkable combination of courage and compassion, so that he wasn't a person who shouted a lot, or when he was angry, he was clear and also able to be compassionate in that same breath. I hope that I have learnt that clarity from him. And I hope that I have also learnt a deep sense of fairness, and fairness not only being taking up the cause of the underdog, but also being a willingness to see the side of the enemy, to see, what is it that got you here? And how is it that I can invite you to be on the side of good and right, rather than harangue you or demonize you? Yeah.
But those are really important things in our world today, aren't they? And like you say, your father was very good at that. I think we could do with a bit more of that sort of attitude.
Yes, we could.
Is there anything more you would like to say about your father in terms of what he was like as a dad? Because obviously we know him as the public figure, and all the amazing work that he did in South Africa to bring about the end of apartheid. But what was he like as a just as your dad, you know, behind closed doors?
Yeah, my dad is very much a what you see is what you get. So the person you saw as a public figure was very much the person behind closed doors. I mean, the stances that he took were also part of our dinner table conversation. His observations and concerns were, you know, this was not just a conversation that he'd have for public consumption, but it was also the experience that we had of him at home. He was very loving, very and very, very observant. Like, he noticed things, and he's, you know, quick with a compliment, you know, like he was definitely the person who would notice if you'd, you know, just had your hair done, or if you had a new lipstick, or, you know, changed the frame of your glasses, or and, you know, that he was that person. And he was also just incredibly admiring of my mom. I mean, you know, to his last days, he, you know, that this was the person who would be hand in hand with my mother into their 90s, and you know, just
that's lovely.
Yeah,
that's so lovely when you see that.
It is. I remember we had gone to Disney in California with some friends and with our kids, young at that time, really young kids. And you know, he had gone with my mom on one of the big rides, and then we had gone on, you know, kind of the kiddie rides with the kids. And he came off the kiddie rides and he was like, oh, that's so boring. You know, he grabbed my mom's hand and said, come on, let's go try the roller coaster again.
That certainly seemed like the kind of person that was full of fun and joy. I think joy is the word that you think of when you think of Archbishop Tutu.
Yes.
And Pope, when you were 31, apartheid was ended in South Africa. That must have been quite an incredible moment. Do you remember that time?
Yes. I mean, I remember Madiba's release and the end of the system of apartheid. Absolutely, yes. It was both a joyful and a tense time, because you'll remember that prior to the elections, there was a great deal of violence. Chris Hani was killed in that time in the run-up to the elections. There was some battle in the townships as the violence, as the IFP and the ANC really were engaged in pre-election battles. And then also that there were Afrikaner nationalists had also been engaging in violence and threats of violence. And so it was both a time of hope and turmoil. But when the election was finally held and Mandela won the election, people queued up for days to vote, and then the outcome of the election was a real source of great joy. And I remember watching the inauguration on television, and the, I think for most South Africans and certainly Black South Africans, the transformation was hugely emotional.
Yeah. It's interesting that racial justice movements have in the past been led by Christians. So people like your dad in South Africa, Martin Luther King, William Wilberforce. It makes you wonder why people of faith largely seem to be missing from things like Black Lives Matter today. Do you have any thoughts on that?
I'm not 100% sure that I would agree that people of faith are missing from those. It may just be that they're not prominent Christian leaders in place of being leaders in Black Lives Matter. In the United States, I think still most Black people would still identify as being Christian. And if not Christian, then certainly people of faith. Faith is, but I think they may not stand on the platform of faith to articulate their stance or to articulate that need. I think that in that mix, you will always find people of faith voicing that. I think also, I don't know what the Black Lives Matter movement looks like in the UK, but I do think also that the white Christian evangelical movement in the US been quite opposed to that Black Lives Matter movement. And so I think that might also have something to do with the appearance that it's not a Christian-led movement, because a lot of the publicity power and the political power sits in the white Christian evangelical community rather than sitting in the Black community.
Holier than thou.
Radical.
Delusional.
Ignorant.
Perfect. It's time to challenge stereotypes about Christians, and Premier Christianity is leading the way.
Transform your perceptions, broaden your horizons, open your mind to wide-ranging views.
Read interviews with politicians, theologians, and TV presenters.
Discover the breadth of the Christian spectrum.
Be provoked, react, inspired, and informed. Get the print magazine and full online access for just £4.95 a month. Subscribe today at premierchristianity.com.
Premier Christianity Magazine.
The bigger picture.
On the profile, we like to ask all of our guests about their journey to faith. You obviously grew up in a Christian household, but when did you start following Jesus for yourself, Impul?
Oh, I don't know. I think that faith was in the water I drank and the air I breathed, and where would I go? Christ has the words of eternal life, and we have believed and come to know that you are the Holy One of God. So why would I be leaving to go somewhere else? What would I be looking for elsewhere when I had found the source of life?
So you didn't have a sort of conversion moment per se, where you sort of turned away from your kind of former life and decided, yeah, I'm going to surrender my life to Jesus. It wasn't that sort of a moment for you.
Nope. No, it has, yeah, it's been a constant walk with God. Maybe there are small surrenders along the way, but it's a relationship like every relationship, that sometimes you're all in, both hands, both feet, and all of your fingernails, and sometimes you're in ish, but it is a relationship that is, yeah, for me, foundational.
And your road to ordination, when did you realize that you were being called to the priesthood?
So I talk about my road to ordination as being something of a backwards road of not resistance, but just maybe ignoring the call, so putting a lot of energy in other places, because I wasn't willing to look at the energy of call that was on my life. And I think what really finally happened for me was in my early 30s, I was running a program at Episcopal Church in Worcester, Massachusetts, and really enjoying the work that I was doing, but really feeling that, you know, I am really good at running programs. I'm really good at creating structures that will stand the test of time. But programs are, even the most wonderful programs are programs. They're not life-giving, they're programs. That's, you know, they're there to do the thing that they're there to do. They're not there to transfigure your experiences and it was that it was like, you know, I can give you the recipe book, but only God can infuse your cooking with soul. And that was the time when it was that really what made the most sense to me was bringing people into that life in Christ.
Your role as a member of the clergy in South Africa came to quite an abrupt end, didn't it, when you married your wife? Can you tell me a bit about that time? How did you feel returning your license?
Incredibly, grief-stricken, actually. At the time, I was still the executive director of the Legacy Foundation. I'm canonically resident in Washington, and so and my primary ministry at the time was as executive director of the Legacy Foundation, and so it was really returning a license for a thing that wasn't the primary source of my income. It wasn't the thing that validated my priesthood. But it was the my home church, the church of my youth, and And so it felt like being being thrown out of home, of being, in a sense, abandoned by the church, and incredibly painful, more painful than I imagined it would be, because it wasn't a piece of paper that was essential for any part of my life, for, you know, kind of my livelihood, shall we say. But it was, it wasn't essential for my livelihood, but it was for my life.
You've said in the past that falling in love with Marceline was as much of a surprise to you as to anyone else. What did you mean by this?
Because people ask, are you lesbian? Are you bisexual? Where do you fit on that spectrum? And I would have told you, if you had asked me, even the year before, are you attracted to women? Yeah, I like women, they're nice, but I'm heterosexual, and that is who and what I am. What I realized is that, I love her because she is her, and in a sense, I think, it was the thing was, if I had fallen in love with a Chinese man or a Russian man or an Indian man, or nobody would have blinked. But I fell in love with a woman, and then it's like, okay, well, what do you do with this? I fell in love with a person, all that comes with that, being a person.
Did it change your view of sexuality in the sense of kind of understanding your own sexuality? You talk about those questions about bisexuality, being a lesbian, those feelings of attraction towards the same sex. That must have been quite a moment. I can't really imagine it, almost, because I do understand what you're saying about falling in love and seeing the person. But as someone who's lived as a heterosexual and been married to a man, that really must have been quite a shock for you. Did it kind of almost blow apart your categories of people and your understanding of what sexuality is and the spectrum? And
I think that's maybe the best description is for me, it was more a recognition that sexuality is on a spectrum, that there are, there are some people who would never look twice, think twice. It's just, that'll never happen. And there are some people who, in terms of, that they will always only ever have a heterosexual partner, and that is, just how it is for them. And there are some people who will only ever have a partner of the same sex, and can only ever be in that kind of a relationship. And then there's the rest of us who are who love who we love, gender notwithstanding, or gender regardless.
Marceline is a white Dutch atheist, as you know. That's not news to you. You must have some really interesting conversations over dinner.
Well, we do have some interesting conversations over dinner, but I think, the one thing that's that makes the relationship possible is being able to be respectful of where each stands. So she's a white Dutch atheist who has a spiritual life, and who in the early years of our relationship, when we were kind of back and forth between countries and I was traveling quite a bit with my dad, my dad would have a daily Eucharist, regardless of where he was. And so sometimes it was a daily Eucharist in the hotel room. And Marceline would come along and be present. She wouldn't join any of the singing or the prayers vocally, but she would come, and it was for her a time of quiet meditation at the beginning of the day, which is okay. I always think actually conversion isn't my job, that's God's job. My job is to live faithfully and living faithfully then allows the space for God's spirit to work.
Have you found yourself challenged by some of her views, or how has your faith changed as a result of your relationship with Marceline, would you say?
No, I haven't found myself challenged. Maybe the scheduling challenges of, why don't we, can we skip church today and go do da da da? Yeah, no, we can't skip church today. We can go after church. and no, I don't want to do, I'm not doing office work on a Sunday. So no, I'm not doing that. And yes, I know it's just this question, but no. So, yeah.
So you've been very clear in your mind. Going back to what you said about your dad, you've had that clarity that you've.
Yeah. We live together and work together on living and working together. Yeah.
Per, you said in the past that you think the church will one day, and I'm quoting you here, come around to see God's way regarding mm-hmm. gay relationships. What mm-hmm. did you mean by this?
Well, I think that we were really challenged by the diversity that God has placed in the world. We're challenged by racial diversity, we're challenged by gender diversity, and we're challenged by sexual diversity. We would rather be laying down the law and, saying this is permissible, that's not permissible, and making the world in the image of our own narrow minds. And over and over again, God keeps blowing open the door. The Spirit keeps blasting through our prejudices throwing flowers in our path in every shade of the rainbow and shades beyond. The church will eventually catch up with God. Maybe.
Hey, this is Sam. Really hope you're enjoying this conversation right here on the Profile podcast today. Could you do me a favor right now? It will take you just 2 seconds to give us a rating and a review wherever you found this podcast. Just a couple of seconds to give us a rating is so, so helpful. It helps other people to discover the show as well. So if you could do that, we would so appreciate it.
Your new book, Forgiveness and Reparation, The Healing Journey, is a poetic exploration of the efficacy of South Africa's Truth and Reconciliation Commission, which was set up in the 90s to remember the human rights abuses of apartheid and to bring some form of healing. What, in your view, were the successes and failures of that commission?
Both. And I think that the book speaks not only to the South African experience, but it speaks also to the experience around the world, because it's a conversation about reparations that is alive not only in South Africa, but everywhere that there are colonial powers, and that would be everywhere. But in terms of South Africa's Truth and Reconciliation Commission, I think the primary success of the commission was in that it gave South Africans a common history of apartheid. The apartheid system was really good at division, and that was its point and purpose, And so the Truth and Reconciliation Commission gave each group of South Africans, each divided group of South Africans, a common understanding of what life under apartheid actually had been like for all of us, because we were all hearing the story in the same room at the same time and hearing of people's experiences in the same room at the same time, and not being able to say, no, that didn't happen. No, that, you know, because the research and that undergirding of the commission was really strong. It also gave those who had been victims of the most gross human rights violations a platform to tell their stories and to begin a process of healing. And the understanding as the commission was established was that it was truth on the way to reconciliation. So we got a lot of truth. We even got a significant amount of forgiveness. What we didn't get was reconciliation, because reconciliation requires that both victim and perpetrator be equally invested in seeing an outcome that is fair for all. And in the way that the commission was set up, the commission was set up in so that those who were perpetrators would, if they made a full disclosure of their deeds, would be granted amnesty from prosecution. The victims, the act that created the Truth and Reconciliation Commission also asked that the commission advise what would be an appropriate reparation recompense for the victims. And by the time that the commission handed in its final reports, the government had changed from that of Madiba to that of Mbeki, and the ANC leadership at that time was really angry because they too had been called to testify as perpetrators for their deeds, particularly in the refugee camps. And so they ignored the recommendations of the commission in terms of reparations. And so victims received no reparations, neither from the government nor from the perpetrators. And so the opportunity to actually begin to cement a healing process was lost.
So based on what you're saying, I presume that Black South Africans now are still massively disadvantaged then because of that.
Absolutely. That economically South Africa looks very much the same as it did under apartheid, that the economic advantages still accrue mostly to the white population. Most wealth in South Africa still sits in white hands, even though there are Black people and, you know, people of color who have acquired wealth, but most wealth still sits in the hands of white South Africans.
In your view, what is the answer to that?
Well, yeah, a real regime of reparations and a real engagement with a wealth tax on white South Africans. And I think, you know, kind of the further you move away from the formal political apartheid, the harder it is to institute.
Do you think the same could be said of North America with in terms of slavery? Do you think there should be something similar there?
Oh, absolutely. North America, Great Britain, most of the Western world actually has reparations to pay, even though for the most part, you know, I mean, it's really easy for Europe to look at North America and say slavery over there. But the reason that the slavery was over there was that, you know, in much of Europe, enslavement wasn't permitted on the territory, but slave holdings and slave wealth has certainly built up the coffers of the colonial powers. And so I think it's definitely to be reckoned with.
You have a really truly sort of international life, and you're sort of quite a global citizen. I mean, I was looking at your website and all the people that you've met and the places that you've been and the projects that you've been involved in. It's really quite impressive.
Thank you.
In your view, how can the church be a force for good in the world in 2022?
So I think that that Christ left us with a really simple mandate: love one another as I have loved you. And, you know, if we take that mandate as our guide, a love that really is self-giving, because we tend to think of, you know, I get to tell you what to do. Where Christ is, I love, I show you by example how to live a life of love, how to live a life that is self-giving. You know, love isn't a power grab. Love is acting for others, on behalf of others. And, you know, taking that stance, taking the stance of radical inclusiveness, taking the stance of standing up for the underdog, taking the stance of ensuring the dignity of all human beings, taking the stance of caring for our planet. All of those things, if the church takes those on seriously, those are transformative.
You've got a really extensive CV that includes writing books, creating artwork, founding organizations, campaigning, outreach. When you look back on your life, what are the projects or pieces of work that you're most proud of?
That's really challenging. I think maybe the places where I have got to, where I've been able to sow seeds, create a base that is sturdy enough, that God can give the increase, that after I am gone, the next person who comes along can come along and make something that is better than I had imagined.
Can you think of a specific example of?
Well, the Legacy Foundation would be one. The Discovery Program at All Saints would be another. The Rape Crisis Hotline in Grahamstown would be another. That there was a solid enough base, solid not meaning huge, just meaning solid. And that, there was something for someone to step on and say, okay, well, we can expand the base and grow the thing in this way, or we can make it more beautiful in that way. But I think would be what I'm proud of as projects.
Finally, Mvolt, your father sadly died last year. What do you see as his legacy?
We are all of the people who he touched and loved and inspired. We're his legacy. All of the people who take up for each other in ways that are unselfish. Yeah, we're his legacy.
You've been listening to The Profile in association with Premier Christianity Magazine.
Want instant MVP status? Join the new Dick's Scorecard Plus program. For $99, Scorecard Plus members enjoy 1 year packed with perks, like $80 in annual bonus rewards, free shipping with no minimum purchase, triple points on 2 purchases, and more. That's over $160 in benefits. Join Dick's Scorecard Plus today and score more than ever. Tap the banner to learn more. Exclusions and terms apply. Visit Dick's.com/scorecardplus for details.